Hi everyone, this is Nathan. I am back with another rebroadcast episode featuring Lori Taylor, our Department Chair for Integrative and Functional Nutrition. Lori and I cover a whole range of topics that I think you're going to enjoy. She is just a fabulous interviewee and really, really gets to the meat of a topic, no pun intended, especially around social justice, nutrition, and integrative mental health. So, tune in and enjoy this fabulous episode. Hey everyone, welcome to the Saybrook Insights Podcast, a proud production of Saybrook University. We're an online, nonprofit, regionally accredited university headquartered in beautiful Pasadena, California. Celebrating 50 years this coming year, our humanistic approach to online education has resulted in thousands of alumni the world over advancing the health and well-being of the communities we serve. My name is Nathan Long, University President and host of this podcast. We're now fully into Season 2 with an exciting slate of guests along with a continuation of our Mindful Moments series. We'll release guest interviews once or twice weekly, and Mindful Moments are currently planned for regular release each week throughout this next semester. Follow us on Spotify, Buzzsprout, or your favorite podcast app. In this episode, I connected with Lori Taylor, our new Department Chair for Integrative and Functional Nutrition. We covered an incredible range of topics related to nutrition, mind-body health, and social justice. Her level of expertise, her ability to break complex ideas into manageable parts, and her incredible knowledge of the field led to a truly inspiring discussion. It's important to note that while this recording took place a few months back, the topics, especially those relevant to COVID-19, remain very timely. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy. To learn more about Saybrook University, visit us online at www.saybrook.edu. And now, Ms. Lori Taylor. Ms. Lori Taylor, faculty member in our Integrative Functional Nutrition program at Saybrook University, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Nathan. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Likewise. So I have been really excited and waiting for this particular episode. You and I have had a series of conversations about a whole range of issues as it relates to nutrition and full health and integrative health. So I'm going to task you today to start us off with, what in the world is this whole thing around integrative functional nutrition? What does it mean to the average everyday Jane and Joe?
Well, it's great that you asked, because a lot of people think they know what those terms mean. And I actually even learned more as I started to study them. So integrative medicine and functional medicine come from two different places, but they have a lot of similarities. Integrative medicine, it was developed by Dr. Andrew Weil, who people might know from Spontaneous Healing, and Dr. David Raichel. And integrative medicine is based on a patient-practitioner partnership at its core, using best available science, lowest intervention treatments first, right? So a progressive approach. But really, it's about the partnership. So I used to think it was an integration of conventional and alternative medicine. No, the integration is actually the partnership with the patient. So that's the integrative medicine, and integrative nutrition is, you know, our part of that in terms of how can we help people with food, or their optimizing their digestive system, or how do we help people have their bodies work a little bit better based on factors that are within their control. So that's the integrative piece. The functional nutrition piece, functional nutrition actually came, it's sort of a packaged and marketed form of natural medicine nutrition. And so in natural medicine, we really also take a progressive approach where the foundation of health has to do with diet. We call it, I think, the factors that contribute to health. And then above that is what's called the vis, it's actually supposed to be vis, but vis medicatrix naturae, meaning the healing power of nature. So what that says is that Our bodies typically know how to heal themselves for the most part if we give them what they need. So in functional medicine, functional nutrition, we're really also taking that and narrowing it down to what's biochemically individual about the patient that's in front of us. Because as most people that have been involved in medicine know, that you learn a lot of things in school and you learn things from the books, but they don't always apply to every patient. So it's really taking that individualized, science-informed biochemical approach in functional nutrition. So we are integrating those in terms of patient-practitioner partnership, best available science, where we are using the lowest force interventions first. And really, you know, in nutrition, we are the low force intervention, right? We are not a high and invasive test or a medicine. We're really looking at how do we support the factors that folks need for health. So it's that approach of the combination of the partnership, best available science, progressive intervention.
I learned like three new things during that whole opening there. Thank you very much. I realized how much I was putting my own definition on integrative health, for example. That's very cool. So thank you for that.
Right. And integrative health does actually integrate stuff from conventional medicine. It's saying we don't care where it comes from. We're going to have a big toolbox, right? But we're going to use what's best for this patient in this circumstance. So probably the things you thought are also true.
Yeah. I mean, I think it hits at the point that you and I were talking about before we started the episode recording today, right? Where, I mean, it's kind of the humanistic definition of integrative, which I really love. Obviously, there is the merging of traditional and complementary / alternative approaches, but it's that relationship between physician or healer and patient or client, right, together. I really like how you position that. I think that was very good. It doesn't mean the other isn't valid. It just pulls that in as a really critical function of what we're doing here today. And then, of course, your explanation of integrative or functional aspects of nutrition is helpful. So maybe before we get into all the COVID-19 stuff today, tell me a little bit more about nutrition. Is it all about just what we eat and drink? Is there more to it? Is that just really super simple? What are your thoughts as a faculty member in the department and as a nutritionist?
Well, that's a big tall order, Nathan. But I will
probably loaded too. Right? It's right? Loaded, right?
So just keep in mind that the things that are simple are not always the things that are easy. You know, we are human beings, and we have evolved and come to a position where in the world where we have a large effect on the world based on our ability to tolerate a number of conditions and eat a number of things. Right. So we have, in general, a lot of resilience environmentally, at least until the last 100 or 200 years, where with the advent of all sorts of chemicals that are foreign, that are man-made, that our bodies haven't seen or haven't had to use anymore. That's changed a lot. But I'm always impressed at when we start to study, and in our program, we take a really strong systems biology approach, which is the basis for functional medicine. So systems biology means we understand how all the basic systems of the body work, not the organs, but the functions, right? So how do we digest? How do we assimilate? How do we get rid of stuff we don't need anymore? Elimination, detoxification. What is necessary for our structural integrity? How does the body traffic in energy? Because understanding those mechanisms helps us understand disease and helps us understand how to not just treat disease, which is medicine, which is larger than the scope of nutrition, but how do we make sure the body has everything it needs and not too much of what it doesn't? So when we study that, I'm always amazed that we're actually alive. When you look at all the inputs that come into our systems and all the wide variety of ways that we eat and how much different our current diet is from very traditional and indigenous diets that humans have been eating for, you know, eons. So nutrition, you know, we are the product of our nutritional environment. And where we're challenged in this day and age is that our nutritional environment has changed so much that it makes it difficult for most folks to eat in a way that promotes good health. I'll give you an example. One of the statistics that my students all leave with is that according to the Centers for Disease Control, there's a very low percentage of people who eat enough vegetables and fruits every day. And the dietary guidelines, which I don't think is a super high bar, is 2 to 3 cups of vegetables and 1 to 2 cups of fruit, right? So Nathan, do you want to take a guess at how many, what percentage of the U.S. population meets those guidelines? Or I can tell you, but if you want to guess, go ahead and guess.
This is kind of fun. It's Stump the President Day, right? So let's say 10%.
You are right on the money, actually. It is 10%.
Oh, my gosh, really? Okay.
A lot of people think it's higher. It's actually 9% for vegetables and about 12% for fruit. But when you look at everyone, it's 10%. So when you look at how foundational that plant food intake is for the health of our microbiome, that is the living environment of other organisms and their genes and their products that live inside of us, and you find that the 90% of people don't have the basic needs to meet the to feed the healthy microbiome, you know, we're all really vulnerable. But what is probably the hardest thing for folks to add to their diets, especially if they're not cooking or they don't have access to fresh food? You know, the vegetables and fruits are things that should be, you know, you should be eating every day and preparing frequently. And it ends up being one of the bigger challenges for people. But it is that nourish first approach that we take in our program, which is where a lot of times in functional medicine, people are pulling things out of the diet like gluten and dairy and specific, you know, pesticides. And not that all that doesn't have a function and a place and an importance, but without the nourishing aspects of whole plant food, you know, primarily vegetables and fruits, the fiber that's in those, the micronutrients that are in those, that's the basic stuff that makes our immune system work properly. And I'm fond of saying, like, I'm a big fan of drag, right? a big drag race fan. And one of my favorite drag queens is named Alaska. And Alaska says, if you're not doing nails, you're not doing, if you're not wearing nails, you're not doing drag. And I say, if you're not treating the microbiome, you're not doing nutrition. Because everything we eat goes through this filter of this living organism in our gut. You know, so we have this, this set of living organisms in our gut that are bacterial, that are fungal. There's a little bit of fungal, viral. In normal natural paleolith, we'd even have a few parasites as part of our normal gut ecology. And there, it's mostly bacteria, though 1.3 times, not 10 times as people think, 1.3 times as many bacterial cells as human cells, but 150 times the genes. So the microbiome is those organisms, their genes, what their genes make, and what the organisms make out of what we eat. So that's like that is a whole system that's happening that's informing the rest of our body. And if we don't give that system what we need, it translates our input into something much more inflammatory and much less healthy. So when you have 90% of the population not able to or not making it happen to nourish that microbiome, then we get a much different response to the other inputs in our system. Mm-hmm. So part of nutrition is really simple in terms of getting that whole plant food, but part of our nutrition environment really makes that challenging for some people. And especially it's not a money issue, it's a time issue, sometimes it's a skill issue. Sometimes it's more than one of those. You know, a lot of people who are working poor have time poverty and are buying for calories. Yeah. People who maybe have more time don't have skill or weren't brought up that way. I often say to my clients and my students that a lot of what I learned about nutrition that was actually helpful, I learned from my mom. You know, I was modeled growing up, and my mom wasn't a nutritionist. She was a stay-at-home mom, but she had, you know, basic food, nothing fussy, but it was very, very, and I try not to use this word balance, but we had fruits and vegetables every day. We had some junk food, but not a lot, you know. So there's most of what it takes to be well-nourished is simple, but not always easy for everyone. So that's really where we start, is to start from that foundation of nourishment.
Yeah, I find that very fascinating. I've been through my own journey over the last few years. I guess maybe that's why I have such a particular affinity for your area at Saybrook. I mean, there's just so many health aspects to my own journey. For example, I used to be really overweight. I went through this whole process of being potentially pre-diabetic and potentially diabetic, I guess, because I was pre-diabetic, and went through this whole reconfiguration of my diet. And it was just personally driven, much to the points you raised. It's getting back to basics, really paying close attention to what I was eating. And I think really hit it on the head with your point of around your mom, right? Your mom laid out a very clear regimen of back to basics, or it was the basics at the time. And I think sometimes we may overcomplicate it, but to your point also, just because it's simple doesn't make it easy. And so really changing behaviors, changing environment, changing the culture that you're within really takes a lot of effort, both personally and maybe as a family or as a community. I really liked how you position that. Thank you. That's good.
Well, and to add to that too, one of the things that is, it really kind of gets to me about healthcare, whether it's functional medicine providers or conventional medicine providers, is if our nutrition, if the environment that we live in, our food environment, is so challenging for most people to achieve health, then it's not to say we shouldn't address it on a one-on-one basis, but really every healthcare practitioner should be involved in public health.
Right.
How do we shift our food environment so that it is more healthy for everyone, so that it does not take this level of work and we put it all on personal responsibility? Because a lot of people think, well, this is easy for me. That doesn't mean it's easy for your patient,
right?
You know, and so, you know, they have, this is why I love also the partnership aspect, is you get to know where your patient is at. And really my goal too, when I'm looking at their diet, is how can I recommend the least restrictive diet for this person? Right. To only, I don't want to make their diet to be now the big challenge in their life. You know, we've got to work together to get to a point of health, but how do we do that without making their world so small where there's 30 things that they can't eat now? You know, so that's the real goal again of this nourish first approach. It's not that we don't restrict or pull out things that need to be pulled out, but we start with nourishment.
So that's interesting. You use that that phrase, least restrictive approach, and I don't want to probably get into too much shop talk, although I could for hours with you. I always enjoy our
conversations. Right.
But if, you know, talk to me a little bit about it. You already, you know, elaborated a bit on least restrictive. So I'm curious, in your conversations with a client or patient, you know, what does that look like when you say, okay, I don't want you to restrict too much? What is the whole totality of their regimen? And I know there's probably more than one care provider in that matrix, but as
sure,
the person
sure.
providing some nutritional guidance, what are some of the key elements that you might provide an individual who's, let's say, suffering from morbid obesity or some other affliction that they might be experiencing?
Right. So really first starting at what's their goal, you know, really identifying with why they want to work with me, why they want to work together. And because a lot of times we lose sight of that. Like I will tell people, if you bring me a diet, I will always tell you something you could fix or improve in it. But that doesn't mean it needs to be, you know, we're going to look at your state of health, what you want to achieve, what level of change you want, but really try to tie it to benefits. So our interventions have to improve that person's quality of life. So let's say someone's coming to see me and they're overweight and they're pre-diabetic. Morbid obesity is actually a pretty tough diagnosis, because it's not that we can't do anything. It's that by the time someone is that overweight, they're actually metabolizing very, very little. You know, their metabolism has become very, very efficient. Their movements are really efficient, and they don't have a lot of muscle mass. They have a lot of fat mass, and fat mass is not metabolically active. It becomes really, really challenging. But I tend to start with a nourish first approach in terms of most people aren't eating those fruits and vegetables to help them. That also helps displace. Your typical American patient will be coming in with not enough whole plant food intake, too much refined carbohydrates. That means like too much probably flour and sugar. Not that either one of those are necessarily bad individually, but the proportions are off, right? Maybe eating poor quality fat, maybe not preparing a bunch of their meals. And what I don't do is there's a lot of folks in natural medicine that will just say, wipe your whole diet, start over with this. I mean, that's a huge thing to ask of a patient. And they'll often say, well, if you're sick enough, you'll do it. Well, you know, if some people, when they're really sick, they actually don't have that kind of energy. So where's your patient at in terms of what I look and identify how they're eating and identify what the strengths are, and then look at some macro level changes that should give them at least more quality of life in terms of improved digestion, or they're eating less of the foods that cause them problems or cause them to be overweight. So just really looking at what are the strengths. When I first see somebody, it will be some tweaks, and then I'll do a more in-depth analysis, have them come back and say, how did those first little experiments do for you? So in terms of like, it's probably more evident if I were to say, let's talk about someone with prediabetes that's carrying some extra weight, right? So first I would look at how's their meal patterning, right? Are they eating regularly spaced out meals, right, to help with blood sugar balancing? And are those meals glycemically balanced? Are they all carb meals? Do they have some protein and some high quality fat to slow their digestion and absorption so they don't peak and fall, right? So sort of some general, I call it like growth tuning. We can't do the fine tuning. You don't choose the color for your drapes before you've built the foundation for your house. Or maybe you do, but you can't put them up, right? So, right. So I first look at like, what's the foundation? And then what are easy changes that we can make where someone's going to have an easier time? So typically somebody who's pre-diabetic and carrying extra weight is eating too many refined carbohydrates and not moving enough. Those are the basic assumptions, and then there's more you can do. So when you look at helping them add plant, you know, whole plant food to each meal, one of the things that does is it has a displacement effect on the refined carbohydrates. And by changing the microbiome, you actually also change cravings. So really, instead of saying, okay, you can't have any white foods, you can't have any rice, you can't have any flour, you can't have any sugar, you got to cut all that out. That's actually very, some people can do that, but it's typically not sustainable for them over a long period of time. When you have a microbiome that hasn't been getting what it needs and you've been feeding it refined carbohydrates, it's going to really give you some grief when you withdraw those foods. And it's not all about willpower. We know that the microbiome can induce dysphoria. The organisms can secrete toxins when they don't get what they want, right? Because you don't have this diverse diet. So what happens, it's just like in our culture, if you don't have a diversity of diet, you don't have a diversity of organisms, you have some that start to predominate, and then sometimes it's the less healthy group. So you have to start feeding that diversity of diet to help shift the microbiome so that it's got the, because it's got all the, I call them the bugs that press the buttons. They have the interface with your immune system, with your nervous system, and you need to learn how to live with them in a good way. And that's really the start of that. Rather than telling patients that they have to come off all carbohydrates, they need to go on a high fat or higher protein diet. And all those things work. It's not that they don't work. It's just, are they going to be sustainable for your patient? And are they going to be achievable? And if you can give folks, I always tell people, if you want a boot camp nutritionist, I'm not your person. I'm not here to shame you or guilt you or yell at you or have some sort of power dynamic where I'm telling you what to do. We're in a partnership, and I'm going to treat you like a human being. And so we're going to do this progressively, and if you want to go faster, we can go faster. But I'm a big believer in that slow is fast. Mm-hmm. And then if you work it slow and progressive, you're actually going to get to your goal rather than if you go whole hog, pull a bunch of things out, try to do something extreme. It may take you longer to get to that goal as people yo-yo in and out of stuff. Like I hear a lot of people that are on keto, and then they break keto, or they're on it for a couple of months, and then they go off and they stay off and they gain a bunch of weight back. Not to say that keto doesn't work, or it's not, there are certain people that it's for, but that slow is fast, nourish first approach tends to build the foundation to be able to make the change that you need. Because a lot of patients will come in and they're not in a state where they can make that kind of change or tolerate it. So, pre-diabetes, extra weight, you know, that's actually one of the more simpler approaches. When you get to things like autoimmune disease, where there are really popular diets like the autoimmune paleo diet, that AIP diet works, but it's so restrictive, and it's not everybody needs all those restrictions. It makes our patient's life much smaller. It's like we would have a lot fewer automobile accidents if we all only went 20 miles per hour right. In the car. But if we all only went 20 miles per hour in the car, there's a real limit to where we could go and what we could do. And it's the same thing with nutrition. The more restrictive we make the diet, the smaller our patient's life becomes. So we really have to look at why we're doing what we're doing. Does it apply to our patient? And is it going to give us the result that we want? And sometimes we don't know, and we try it and then we reevaluate it. But it's really building that foundation in terms of regular meals, enough whole plant food, then decreasing some of the things that are inflammatory. And it's just a building approach that happens. And with autoimmune disease, I don't start with taking everything out. You know, typically we look at, yeah, you do need to remove gluten and possibly dairy, but are you sensitive to lectins or nightshades? Well, we can figure that out. You know, let's see what kind of function we get when we do this thing, you know. And it's not to create a sense of dependency. I always tell my students, you know, you don't want your patients to be dependent on you. You want to encourage their growth and independence, but sometimes it's going to take you a while to figure out what that person needs. So,
no, I think you raised so many viable, good points. Maybe it was the advice you gave me or one of the faculty in the department gave me. It was a while back. We were talking about it. So in my own journey over the last 6-7 years, not that this is about me, but it's kind of interesting that we're talking about all the ins and outs of slow and steady and least restrictive. The idea, right, that it takes time. I think maybe you were the one who brought this up. I'm at the tail end of this long, very long journey of losing a lot of weight. And I've been plateauing, and I've been doing, as you mentioned, I talked to a couple different medical professionals, and they're like, oh, you should do this Atkins type of thing, or you should do this or that. And I think you or Jean Marie or one of the faculty members said, why don't you try measuring your food and eating more plants and vegetables in general and fruits, and just monitoring your intake a little bit more mindfully and seeing if that makes a difference. And that wasn't fun or sexy enough for me, right? I'd rather eat 12 steaks in a day, Lori. Come on, right? You know, we had this really big epiphany, or I did have this, I had this really big epiphany about a month and a half ago, because I wasn't doing like obsessive calorie counting, but really just measuring what I was taking in. And I had already shed quite a few pounds already, down another 15, 16 pounds and down 20 as of this week. And it's not just about the pounds or the loss, right? It's really, for me, it's getting to that as at middle age, positioning myself for a quality of life. It has less to do with how I look, more to do with how I feel. But you were exactly so right in how you position that. And it's taken a long time. I mean, I won't say that it's fun, right? Because I think in American society, it's all about the immediate fix, the now, the must have. And I really appreciate how you position that, because I myself included, I just want it done. I mean, I got to get on to this next project or that next thing. And, I think by even just having someone say, it's going to take you a while. Why don't you just start counting how much you're putting into your bowl, you know, or your glass. And, so anyway, I appreciate how you.
Well, you know, and it's interesting too, because people want sometimes, they'll put me in the position of a practitioner of me wanting them to have some sort of pure diet, right? And to be honest, when you're looking at diseases that have to do with carbohydrate intake and how we balance blood sugar, which is a lot, we have a lot of that. It's a huge driver in heart disease. You know, we now know that we've known for a while, 20 years or 25 years, that low fat, high carbohydrate diets really don't work for weight loss or heart disease. They actually make things worse.
Yeah.
But you can actually improve your lot in life, even if you don't change what foods you're eating in terms of carbohydrates, but you look at controlling the amount, the total, what we call glycemic load. Now, yeah, maybe it should all be whole grain and organic and perfection, but I had a client once who had some pretty bad, he was going from prediabetes into diabetes, and he was taking care of his mom, and he worked at a factory, and he worked at a refinery. He ate breakfast at McDonald's. He ate lunch. He was living by himself, and he was taking care of his mom. He ate breakfast at McDonald's, ate out of the vending machine, and then would pick something up and bring it home for his mom, and they would have dinner together. I mean, he was like carrying quite a lot. So instead of telling him he had to stop eating McDonald's and stop eating, you know, we worked at what can you have at your desk, but also, okay, when you're going to go to McDonald's, this is how you keep from getting too many carbs, right? So this is the sandwich choice. This is where you need to eat. This is the sandwich choice you should have, and you need to have a beverage that's not juiced or soda, you know. And so I was actually subbing for another dietitian at a local hospital, and I got the call from his physician, like, I don't know, 4 weeks later, saying, what did you do with this guy? His numbers are here, and he's so much better. And was he on some sort of restrictive diet? And I was like, I have to, you know, I had to tell this person, we really just looked at controlling his carbohydrate intake. That was the only thing we did, because that's all this guy had space to do. And that humanity in my heart, I wasn't going to tell him he needed to go and cook all three meals a day. And, you know, and he was grateful. And from that period, from that point, he then had more energy and more bandwidth to take care of his mom and do more things for himself. And he kind of went off on his own. And it's that you really have to look at where people are and not require some sort of perfection. Sometimes it's about harm reduction. Sometimes it's about where can I plug in and where am I going to, what kind of quality of life am I going to get? Wow. You know, so it's really meeting them where they're at, meeting your IBS patient with maybe just a modified shift in their diet and some digestive enzymes, when maybe they really need a whole elimination diet and a whole gut rebuild, but it's never going to happen. So how do you help that person without requiring so much, you know, sainthood of them? And that's, I've always been about that humanistic, before I knew what humanistic meant, treating people and seeing people as people in my career. So when, you know, when I found Saybrook 5 years ago, it was such a match made in heaven for me, because so much of what we do in medicine and so much of what we do in functional medicine and nutrition isn't often very humane. And we have to look at this, we have to value this person that's sitting across from us more than an idea. You know, more than something we learned in school. We have to see them as a person and work with them as a partner. So I really enjoy my work now at this point in my career, after being a dietitian for 20 years, really helping to train the next level of practitioners in how can we help people with this advanced skill set that we have, but we do it in a humane way and in a way that improves their quality of life and improves the quality of the planet. You know, that's the whole piece for me.
What a great way to put that. And I think, you know, to build on it, yeah, I'm a huge science advocate and a huge fan of the medical establishment. I tend to maybe be on the other side of things oftentimes in terms of very pro-support of traditional and also the integrative approaches coming together. I think there's value in both. But the one thing I think that science and medical science can get wrong is, you know, the aggregate, you know, the focus solely on the aggregate. And I think you said that so beautifully in terms of, you have these important data sets that inform kind of large scale practice, how we work with and can treat our patients. And we have clinical trials that help direct our efforts accordingly. But in the end, that mind-body approach, right? Those two things that come together. When you have that individual sitting across from you, I thought your story was really quite good around the gentleman who, you know, in addition to all that he was dealing with at work, was trying to take care of his mom and himself. And you said it really nicely. All he had space for was don't drink juice and soda and eliminate some carbs in your diet. I mean, and here's how you can do that. But you know, honestly, to your point, you probably gave him so much hope and he was so much more motivated after a month of just seeing some preliminary results. But that wouldn't have happened necessarily. And I certainly don't want to knock the establishment dietitians who are out there that you're working with day in and day out. Everyone's doing their best to support their patients. But I think we all can get caught up in the data, right? And that we forget right. That there's this flesh and blood right. Person across from us who's dealing with all these other things. That
right.
In life. Yeah.
It's the data. Sometimes it's the protocol. Sometimes it's the conventional wisdom. We forget that those things are guidelines that have to apply to the person sitting in front of us, you know, and in functional medicine, there's a lot of protocol. And sometimes I think there's a lot of Kool-Aid drinking in medicine in general, that this is the way we approach this thing for everyone. And it is the only way to approach it. You know, that's always worrisome. Like I said, when we value an idea, we give an idea more value than the person sitting in front of us. You know, that idea is important, but it's supposed to inform our care, not oppress the person we're trying to help. You know?
Or do damage, right? On either side of the spectrum. You know, I think, as you and I have talked about, I think it's problematic in any doctor-patient relationship, health practitioner-patient relationship, and we get caught up in that. That's good. So I maybe take a slight turn, if we could, for a moment.
Sure.
I know we're coming to the close of this episode, and you do know you're coming back for maybe two or three or maybe 10 more of these, because I can talk.
I'm so shy, Nathan. I don't know if I can do it.
I know.
But, you know, I'll try.
You're doing a great job. This is so enjoyable. I appreciate it. So, you know, I just as a kind of a quick preamble or preface to my question, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and that type of thing online, and I'm sure a lot of people have. And one of the things that's kind of been a common theme, and it's no longer funny to me, it's all these people talking about, well, I've put on COVID-19 weight, or I'm just depressed and I'm eating everything and anything. There's a lot in that, right? So it used to be kind of funny, oh, we're stuck inside for 2 weeks. Now I'm starting to see this pattern in our existence. And it's probably not just in the United States, it's probably globally that people are really struggling with this. You know, this notion of just eating to fill holes and gaps and coping in whatever way possible, drinking too much or what have you. And I guess, you know, not that this may be totally in your domain, but I'd be curious from your perspective, both as a scholar and a practitioner in integrative functional nutrition, how are you seeing this manifest itself in COVID-19 in terms of nutrition and health? And what are some of your thoughts around how all of us can start thinking maybe a little bit differently in terms of how we're engaging with our surroundings, given we're so closed right now?
You know, there's a number of approaches you could take to that. I just want to be sensitive to realize, like, I'm doing okay. You know, we have remote graduate education, so, like, I'm still working, and you've been working from home for some period of time. For some people, that is a completely new thing to adjust to, and it does take some adjusting to do it. And some people are facing serious income instability and food instability. So it's really a different response for every person, because it's affecting people differently. For those who are newly at home and have enough food, I think that the pandemic really shines a light on where your self-care routines are. And for a lot of people, especially people that have kids, a lot of that's hung around the school day, you know, getting to bed by a certain time, getting kids up for a certain time, getting them out the door, getting everybody's lunches packed. You know, it's a huge, I was reading some article that talked about the FTE involved in getting kids out the door to school, like how many hours of parent time it took to do that, you know. So we had all of these things built in our system. Here in Washington, we're not having any school in session in a physical place for the remainder of the calendar year. We don't know what the fall is going to be like. So kids are at home. Some parents are at home. And so it really, I find it very challenging, because when you have this much autonomy on your everyday schedule, it becomes easy to let things go or say, I'll do this in a little bit. And then it's like you get to a point in your day where you might realize, either you haven't eaten, or you didn't get enough sleep, or you jumped right out of bed and got into work, and so you haven't showered, you know. And there's all those things that affect, you know, what you're going to do. So you get to a point where you realize you haven't eaten, or your energy is low, or you need something to get you through the next bit of time. And I think it's a good opportunity for people to learn where their routines are solid, and where there maybe need to be a little more solid. And I will say that I think self-care routines It's another one of those simple but one of the hardest things to do, because when you're a parent, you can, depending on the age of your children, you can kind of dictate stuff. It really requires you to parent yourself, right? And some part of it's fun for a while that, well, okay, I can get up a little later because I could work a little later in the day. But if you let that kind of stuff persist, then you end up giving a family dinner time or something that you wanted to do at the end of the day that now you've got to work because you haven't gotten all of your work done, or you don't do your work and now you got to catch up the next day. So those challenges about your self-care routines, I think now is kind of like a boot camp for those. If you're not dealing with, yeah, you know, not having enough income and not having enough food, is to really, really, really have the, it's a discipline and it takes time to set those standards for yourself of, when am I going to go to bed? When am I going to get up? Who makes the breakfast? You know, that is actually the stuff that nutrition professionals deal with all the time. I say that people don't like it sometimes. I think they want it to be a more glamorous profession, but sometimes we're translating scientific concepts into pots and pans and daily routines. You know, but that is where the rubber meets the road. In terms of, you know, one of the things I try to do when people find themselves going to the fridge, you know, too often because it's closed or they're needing some energy or they're needing stimulation, is to really, whenever I see people doing that, I always ask them, you see it when they work outside the home in late day eating, right? They eat their dinner and then they're snacking all night and that's sort of killing their health, or it's really making their weight challenging. I will always back up and say, well, I think you need to get some more food in earlier in your day so that it doesn't affect your evening. But for some people, it's not a lack of food. It's actually a lack of pleasure, a lack of doing things that they enjoy. And food is supposed to be pleasurable. So it sort of substitutes, but it can become a pathology when it substitutes for the meaning, some other things you might not be getting in your life. So I really try to take sort of that holistic approach. And if you can confine your eating to meals as much as possible, that's better for you. And if you're not making it from one meal to another, really look at solidifying your breakfast and your lunch to be, you know, more hearty. That often helps people too. But sometimes when I'm in that, I'm back, why am I looking at the fridge? You know, I just ate or I've been working on something, I'm tired. I really try to go outside if I can. Even 5 or 10 minutes of time spent out, so you can kind of sort about, what is it you need? Do I need to eat? Do I not need to eat? And when you get some more clarity about that, then at least you're making that decision from a place of intention. Yeah. You know, and there are times when I'm like, you know what, I would just like to have a cookie right now because I'm having a bad day. I think that would make me feel better, you know. And there's, you know, food is supposed to be pleasurable. All the things that we need for survival have a pleasure aspect attached to it. That's not necessarily something that's wrong, as long as you know what you're doing. It's not a frequent, you know, it's not a frequent coping mechanism, and you're limiting, you know, you're not having huge portions of stuff.
Right.
But it is a challenge. Like, COVID is really shining a light on a lot of things for people, what works, mostly what works and what doesn't work, where there's inequity in society and where there isn't. And, you know, so I think this is a time that, if you can use that information to improve your health, it's, you know, we have some time. I'm interested in what's going to happen. You know, we have to parse out all the medical issues of all the people that didn't get their mammograms and, you know, what's, you know, all our hospital vehicles, what's the effect of that? But what about all the people who aren't rushing to work every day and eating outside the home and they're cooking more, you know? You know, are there GI problems getting better? Is there sleep?
You know, that's a great point.
To, you know,
yeah.
I don't know how we're going to sort it out, but it's going to be interesting to look back and see what changed in this period of time. But I really just want to be sensitive too. Like, I haven't gotten my stimulus check yet. There's a number of people that haven't. We have great unemployment policies in the state of Washington that deal with gig workers and sole proprietors. But there are some people out there that, you know, specifically things like hairdressers and folks that have really small businesses that are struggling during this time. And while some of us are worried about, like, putting on extra weight, there's a lot of folks that are just, like, not sure how they're going to survive the next 6 months. So I just, like, try to hold the entirety of it for people and see, you know, the hard thing about this time is that we're also disconnected from each other physically. So it is hard to know what other people's experience is like unless we make an intentional aspect to do it. So there's just a lot. This time is really fertile for learning a lot about ourselves, our society, what works, what doesn't, And I just encourage people to try to approach that from a place of curiosity rather than a place of guilt or shame. So this is how we put weight on feedlot animals, sadly, is that we confine them to a space and we give them liberal carbohydrates, right? So it is kind of, you're not getting out to do some physical exercise. It is the primo way to gain weight. That's true. So it may be that now you have to be more intentional about making sure you get a walk. Having a dog's a great thing because they love, you know, all the dogs are getting all the walks right now. But
they're highly confused that they're getting the walks. They're not sure why.
It's great that these people are here, but
right.
So, you know, this time I think is really fertile with a lot to learn if we can try to be at a place of curiosity and compassion. A lot of what goes on in nutrition has to do with people feeling guilt and shame where it's not appropriate, and to really just try to learn from where you're at and look at what you want for yourself. You can do to shift that.
You hit on a point that I think I have to say I'm really glad you highlighted it, which is the issue of food insecurity, right? So we all know people in our circle of friends and family that have either lost their job or are their reductions in force. There's fear of losing their job. Certainly businesses are going through a lot of stress right now, as well as the individuals who are their employees. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, for someone who's experiencing food insecurity, and I know there's no silver bullet, but you might have some ideas here about, ways in which people can cope with this. But someone has lost their job and they're on a really tight budget. What are some basic things that individual or those individuals can do to address that, that need for food, keep it in a budget that's reasonable, especially given, and I know there are a lot of contingencies, right? It also depends on where one lives. There's plenty of food deserts out there. So I'd be curious your thoughts on that.
Well, that is probably one of the most challenging areas in nutrition. And it's one of the things that I try to expose students to, is that how do you help a patient who's on food stamps and has $220 a month for two people, right? How do you help that person with the resources in your community get enough of the right things to eat? And it's difficult because, we have great food banks out here, but food banks pretty much traffic in non-perishable stuff. And so really, and right now in the time of COVID, I don't know if you've noticed, but, grocery stores aren't exactly having sales on anything.
Right.
They have some, but they know now that, that's a pretty low margin business, but now they have all the people that used to be eating out or doing other things or doing more cooking. A lot is changing. And we have this food supply where we have people who don't have enough to eat, and we have farmers dumping food. And now with all the illnesses in the meat plants, you have some of these people raising animals starting to euthanize their animals. So we have it's not that we don't have enough food in the U.S. First of all, I just want to say that we have this huge distribution problem. So the food is there. We're actually throwing some of it away rather than feeding hungry people because we can't figure out a way to get it from point A to point B, or our economy is not geared toward localized food production. But to get to your reality, if you're the person that doesn't have a job and you're facing income security, one of the things I say to people is really try not to have nutritional goals. You don't need to have a holier than thou diet. You're buying basically for calories. If somebody's going to the store and broccoli is $3.99 a pound and they can get two Kraft mac and cheese for 99 cents and they got $400 that month, I think it's irresponsible to buy the broccoli, to be honest. You've got to get your family through this. So that's one thing is to recognize that to get through this is to really, it's not going to be perfect. And it's going to be interesting with all of our people that do have money and do have access that are on a gluten-free, dairy-free, organic, so and such diet, because we're going to have food chain issues where they're not going to be able to do that. And unless you're raising your own food, which most people aren't, all of us are going to have to shift what our expectation level is and become more frugal. Most people who are poor are already pretty frugal. They don't need to become more frugal. It's a hard counsel. You've got to look for where's the food bank in your area. you know, and try to get your staples at the food bank if you can, and save your budget for fresh foods for health. But if you can't, you really just have to look at, how do I buy for calories? How do I maximize what I'm getting? How do I, it's one of the reasons that we started eating grains as a culture, is they gave us some stability and they spread out the fat and protein for us to survive. So people are, I think the hard thing is for folks that are really struggling and living paycheck to paycheck, a lot of those folks are working a couple of jobs and don't necessarily have time to cook. So they're also having to reformat how they feed themselves. And so there's not a one-size-fits-all answer. It's really to try, not to have any goals for nutritional sainthood, not necessarily to eat junk food, but to realize that this is something that your family is going to get through. It's not always going to be like this. So how can we optimize what we're doing? How can we make food and freeze it? Or how can we spread out this meat that we have to last over three meals by adding, you know, whether it's rice or vegetables or whatever. There's no easy, this is the answer. It's really about meeting each family, and like, because also you can have kids who won't eat some of the stuff that you bring home, right? Yeah. So I wish I had something a little bit more direct. I would say make really good use and knowledge of the food banks in your area. Like in our area, we have a lot of retired people that have pretty stable incomes. So we actually have people in our area that are donating their stimulus checks to local charities, right? The folks in our community that make masks, they had a mask selling event at the local food bank and donated everything and donated their proceeds to the food bank. So there's a lot more awareness around food insecurity now during this time, but there's also increased demand. So it's really a matter of, if you've got the time, because you're not now working, there may be some more time to do some cooking and some more scratch cooking, which is a way to save money and to spread a meal. But to really focus on buying for calories and doing the best you can with fresh foods, but not trying to be nutritionally pure. You know, and for most folks that are already struggling, they've already been there, so they kind of know how to do it. Yeah. But this is an even more challenging time for a number of folks. And some, I saw somebody the other day talking about a picture of late stage capitalism, which was people in $30,000 cars lined up at the food bank in big bread lines with people trying to get food. So we do have this affecting a greater sector of the population. So I really don't know, what are we 2 months into this, how it's going to pan out over time. But I know there's at least an effort in our area where we have a lot of agriculture and a lot of gardens for people to actually be growing a portion of stuff and giving it to other people, you know. So I think we have to really try to stay connected with our neighbor as much as we can from a physical distance, and be aware of who needs help, and try to support those resources in our community that are helping folks with food insecurity. But I don't, you know, we're probably going to have to start supplementing the food budgets for people, depending on how long this goes on. You know, like I said, we're in the very early stage, but it's really hard to know. But that's a super big challenge, Nathan. I used to tell people on food stamps, like, try to get your staples at the food bank and save your food stamps for fresh food and watch the sales. And, you know, even that requires a lot of time and attention, believe it or not, to manage. So,
absolutely.
So I'm just glad you brought up the question, because we do need to be aware that not everybody's having the same experience here.
No, and I think you redirected that really beautifully. You know, as we talk about those in abundance who are struggling through, I really think we haven't paid enough attention to the food insecure and those who are really trying to do their level best with their families and themselves around how they treat their, not only their bodies, but their environment and their family situation and watching their weight and doing all the right things. You offered, I think, some really important guidance, and not least of which was remove the shame. Like, right now our job is to get through this individually, right, as families and as a society. And I think so often we're so grounded in shame and blame and Well, you should be doing this. Well, for so many, it's not even possible. We're just trying to, so many are right. just trying to figure out what the next meal will look like for them and
right.
their kids. Yeah.
And then we have to look at our environment and our economy and say, how did we get into this position where so many people are food insecure? Right? Why is, and part of it is we've been part of a consumerized culture where we've now outsourced all of our nutrition needs to something outside of ourselves. So there's a lot less of things that people know how to do to take care of themselves because there's lost skills. Lots of people don't grow anything. Mm-hmm. Some people live in a space where they can't. But that whole, this all begs the question, why do we put it all on the backs of the individual? What is it about us as a society that we have created, whether intentionally or unintentionally, where so many people are food insecure and so many people are living paycheck to paycheck? Now that is, that's the underlying condition for many people, you know, and COVID, there's underlying conditions of obesity and cardiovascular disease and hypertension and diabetes. But the underlying condition in our country is that we have a food environment that does not produce health. It produces obesity and malnutrition and micronutrients. And for a number of people, they don't have food security. So that's why I said I hope this time is a really fertile time to be noticing things and thinking about what kind of world we want to create coming out of this. It's clear we're not going to go back to the way things were. And rather than mourning that, accept it and say, well, how would we like to make a difference? What's going to create health in most people, you know, and it's health for the planet. And, you know, that's going to be, I hope we have the political and interpersonal fortitude to actually get to some creative and regenerative solutions. I think at least it's good to think about what you want it to be, rather than feel hopeless, to say, okay, this is one of the things I learned from DBT, dialectical behavioral training, is radical acceptance, right? This is where we're at. Well, you know, looking back, I think 3 or 4 months ago, we couldn't have envisioned where we are now. And it's hard to know what's kind of coming in the future, but I think it's clear to folks that we can't go back to we're not going to be able to go back to the way things were. So many unknowns with this disease, but it does give us an opportunity to think about what kind of future we want to create. And as COVID shines a light on the things in our culture and our society that do and don't work, it's a really fertile time to be thinking about how we could do things better. How could we do things differently that would make sure more people have their basic needs met, that the design of our society does not include food insecurity and income instability for people? And how do we do that fairly and equitably and in a way that we can hopefully all come to some sort of agreement on? And I hope that we have the personal compassion and sort of intellectual fortitude to be able to do that together and really use this as a moment to seek more unity and to realize that we all have more in common than we have differently. You know, that we have that we all have more in common than we do that differs with one another. And that this, it's an old trope to say that in Chinese characters, the character for crisis is also means opportunity. And I think radically accepting where we are and taking a look at it and trying to think about how do we want things to be different is a really important opportunity that we have at this time to create a society, to create a culture, to create a world that is more humanistic. So
that's great. And thank you.
Yeah,
and
then we look at our planet as the big, the super client, you know, that we're not separate from it, that, you know, it's humanistic and we are connected to this big blue ball and that we forge a future that is more regenerative for all of us. That's my hope. I can always hope.
I think we all share that hope at Saybrook, and what a great person to articulate that then. In yourself. We have really enjoyed, I was just telling you in the short break we took, what a pleasure it is, an inspiration to talk about these things. What we've discovered, I think, on this particular episode is that, like all of the things we study at Saybrook, the intersections across mind, body, health are many. Psychologically, yeah. Sociologically, the medical sciences that inform everything that we do. So really, really fantastic insights from you today, Lori. And you're going to come back. I think the next thing I really want to dive into, and I don't know that it would be appropriate for today, but I think everyone is really wanting to know what are the big myths around nutrition. So maybe we could spend a little bit of time on that next go around.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nathan, for this opportunity. It is always a pleasure to talk to you, and I am so grateful to be at Saybrook where I can practice and teach nutrition in a way that's humanistic. That's a dream come true for me.
Hear, hear, and glad to call you colleague. So it's wonderful to have you here today.
Thank you. All righty. Thank you.